You are listening to Spokane Public Radio. Welcome to the bookshelf and welcome back to the Scottish coast as Jonathan, Amy, and Anya settle into their new home in the town of Crail. Tonight we continue The Desk on the Sea, read and written by Jonathan Johnson.
It took about a minute before Amy wept the first time she saw our cottage. Number 41, Shoregate. Built into a hill beside a tiny harbor at the bottom of a steep, narrow lane of cottages. Thick, whitewashed walls and a red tile roof. Seven windows and a glossy red front door, all facing the harbor and the sea beyond. We were jet-lagged and exhausted when I opened the red door to the homey, musty smell of an old interior on a damp coast. Amy and Anya stepped inside, and I followed them into the low-ceilinged kitchen and the living room with its stone fireplace, up the stairs to the bathroom, where I pointed out you can sit in the tub and look out at the sea, and the two bedrooms, ours with another fireplace, and 19th-century oil paintings in gilded frames. Understand, we lived the first year of Anya's life in a tiny cabin with no electricity. Even now, we are not people with the means to have 19th-century oil paintings on the walls of a 17th-century cottage with antique furniture and a view of the sea. For the previous 6 months, we've lived on my income from teaching college, and every cent of Amy's salary as a social worker has gone into the bank to get us here. When I had come alone in May, scouting for somewhere for us to live, I'd found this place my first day, less than 5 hours after landing. I'd driven my black rental Saab to Crail, the village circled in red marker out at the end of the Fife Peninsula, on my huge map, pulled down the narrow lane, and parked beside the harbor. The little white cottage facing the harbor and sea had looked like a postcard, a cliché expression, I know, but in fact I have since seen the cottage on a postcard, as well as a jigsaw puzzle and a calendar. The inside, the fireplaces and French paintings, the old wood furniture, the view of the sea out every window, had looked like the intimate stage setting for some magical old play. The owner had never let it out before. The rent would be high, but far less than she could have gotten letting it out by the week, and we'd saved just enough to cover it. When Amy, Anya, and I were all finally there together, and I'd finished showing off our new home to them, I led Amy over to the window in our bedroom. "When the haw clears," I said, showing off the Scots vernacular I'd learned for sea fog, "we'll be able to see the Isle of May 5 miles out. The lighthouse starts at dusk. You can see it from every window in the cottage." She turned and hugged me. "It's perfect." I heard the catch in her voice, and when she looked up at me, she had to wipe her eyes. My mother was born in Southern California and spent her childhood in sight of the Pacific, but her entire adult life was lived far from the ocean. Lake Superior, with its seagulls and waves and occasional ships on the horizon, became her surrogate inland sea, and she grew to love it. The smell of salt water, though, the brine in the breeze and on your hands all day, my mother never stopped missing that smell. "Bring me some shells, just a couple," she would tell Amy whenever the two of us were departing for some seacoast trip, "and don't wash them." Amy loves to beachcomb and always obliged. She brought my mother back grocery bags filled with that maritime smell on shells and sand dollars and driftwood. So I have given my family and myself this: the sea, the coast of Fife, a 370-some-year-old cottage, a little village into which we might weave a bit of our lives, and the Isle of May's lighthouse light every evening. It's all outward, all material variables, dreamlike as it is. Certainly my mother would approve. But it's my deepest desire that this place will be just the setting. My deepest desire is that my mother would also approve of what happens among us, of how we love one another, and how we live with the year we'll have here. A day or two ago, our landlady, Isabel, wrote to tell us her neighbors in London would be staying a couple weeks in the cottage next door to us. The father, Jeff, is an actor with a part in an Edinburgh play to which he'll commute. The rest of his family will be here with him on holiday. The family, minus Jeff, arrives, and we have a nice chat with Nina, the mom, who suggests a drink one of these nights soon. We meet Sam, 9, and his sister, Edie, 3. In just a day, Anya and Sam are the best of pals, out with nets and a bucket, catching shrimp and hermit crabs from the rock pools for hours, coming in only with the tide. It's another day before I meet Jeff, who is familiar to me at once, his tousled hair and the friendliness in his eyes and voice. "I've seen him in something," I tell Amy. "No, you haven't," she says, with a "you and your overactive imagination" tone. Amy's usually right about my penchant for the fanciful, but in this case, I'm sure. I just can't place him. Later, I see him out the window, putting Edie in a stroller, and I notice the black embroidery on his black fleece jacket, a subtle, small HP4 crew up near the collar. Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Maybe the Actors Equity in Britain gets its members crew jobs when they aren't otherwise working, I think. But walking up toward the green grocer on the high street for potatoes and carrots, I've got it. He's Amos Diggory. It's that same winsome smile. He's the father of Harry Potter's doomed schoolmate, Cedric. Back at the cottage, I pop in the DVD, and yes, it's him, in a walking hat and glasses just like those he was wearing today. I skip ahead to the credits. Jeff Rawl. When I tell Anya who Jeff is, she is quiet a moment as she considers this information. "Okay," she allows, but asks if we can get back to our playing. Before I'd left for the green grocer, we'd been Harry and Ron. "Harry has a broken arm, Daddy. He's in the hospital wing." 2 evenings later, Amy, Nina, Jeff, and I are in our living room having the drink Nina suggested. The kids are upstairs in Anya's room, where the bedspread is a Harry Potter quilt made by Amy's mother. There is also a little flying car and Hogwarts Express train I bought for Anya in the Highlands when I was cottage hunting. Downstairs, we're having a lot of good laughs. They want to hear the story of what we're doing in Crail. Amy says we're here to slow down and enjoy one another. She's taking the year away from her work with abused and neglected children. I add that I've decommissioned my email, taken a sabbatical from teaching, and disappeared from the literary world. Not that the literary world is exactly in hot pursuit of me, I add. "Brilliant," they agree. I confess I've recognized Jeff, explain how Harry Potter is a part of our daily family culture, how we're in character about half the time as Ron, Harry, and Hermione. I raise my glass and thank Jeff for his part in that. I can see the satisfaction in his eyes, although he says, "A very small part." Oh no, that last scene when you discover Cedric is dead is the first real moment of existential pathos in the series. "That's right," Nina agrees. She says she loves that we're so close to Anya that we share her imaginative world enough to play Harry Potter as we go about our days. She tells us about Sam being rendered speechless by a tour of the set that included sitting in Harry's bed. He never talked about it, or about his dad in the film. Amy nods and says, "Anya wants it to be real. She's hoping for her Hogwarts letter when she's 11. "That's it, exactly right," Nina says. "For Sam, it's not supposed to be a film his dad's in, but a world." Later, Anya will tell me that, upon seeing her Harry Potter things, Sam told her his dad played Amos Diggory. "And?" I will ask. "That's all. We played," she'll tell me. The night goes on, and Jeff tells us about the world of British theater, in which I've had a recent interest. I've got this screenplay on the life of John Keats that I'm finishing, and have considered writing again as a stage play, though I can't bring myself to tell Jeff that yet. My desire to tell Keats's story is a secret I've kept most of my adult life from everyone but my mom and Amy. I do tell Jeff I'd like to see the play he's in, though, and he says he'll get me a ticket. Nina and Amy talk about the time both have spent away from jobs to parent full-time. Nina invites us to use their house in London if they are away over Christmas. "Ah, see there, I've drunk all your beer," Jeff finally declares. "We're all off to Edinburgh first thing or we'd stay late." So it's good night, with more laughs and plans for another get-together soon. To say that Amy and Anya and I are lucky, the three of us alive together, in love every day, with enough money to get by here fine for a while, in this cottage beside the North Sea, where our neighbors for the next few weeks are an actor from Harry Potter and his kind family, to say that we are lucky seems not nearly enough. In the sun, the village of Crail has a vaguely Mediterranean feel. Whitewashed houses with tile roofs line narrow lanes down to the shore. People live outside, eating, drinking, playing cards at metal tables. Flowers pour from window boxes and hanging buckets over garden walls of stone sun-warmed to the touch. Today, though, Crail doesn't feel Mediterranean at all. Crail feels like nowhere but Scotland. For 2 days, mist has taken turns with rain. The only insistent colors in the harbor are the shades of blue on fishing boats, the red of the life ring box mounted to the stone seawall, and the bright overcoat of an occasional passing ambler. The seawall itself is a thousand muted tones of earth and green in the lichened rocks, mortared together for centuries. Waves lift white from the gray North Sea to end on gray rocks. The horizon is the change in shade where gray loses its undercurrent of green to become low, damp sky. I'd call the Isle of May a ghost, but if I did, I'd be speaking more about us. We've been up haunting the high street. We left our umbrellas outside each establishment, first the little post office where we sent off our letters to friends back home. In the Beehive gift shop, we bought playing cards for teaching Anya to play poker tonight. In the bakery, we learned that the closest thing they have to sourdough bread is soda bread, and we bought 4 scones of it, one of which I'm now enjoying at my desk, toasted with marmalade and tea. At First Fruit's Green Grocer, it was potatoes and carrots and corn on the cob to have with dinner. One more stop at the tiny co-op grocery store for sparkling water, cream cheese, and smoked salmon, and we'd made our way up to where the road bends north toward St. Andrews. There we passed the Gopher Tail, as we call the pub, after my misunderstanding of the real name, the Golf Hotel, when I first heard it said in a Scottish accent. We stopped in at the tiny library, open Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 1 to 5, and also Tuesday evening from 6:30 to 8. If part of the reason we are here is to learn to live slowly, the rain helps. Moving from shelter to shelter, with each outing between involving umbrella and chill and damp, we somehow more fully inhabit the day as it passes with us in it. We've only been here a week and a half, but I'm determined to keep moving like a slow ghost. Now that I've found this much quiet awareness, I'm resolved to keep it. I remember how my mother would stop my dad as he pushed her up a sidewalk to this or that doctor's office so that she could smell and admire some small flower I might once have called ordinary. I remember how she'd sit in the car, door open beside the playground, and call, "Doing great, kiddo," to Anya, who swung hand to hand from one rung to the next. She could find more reason for satisfaction and gratitude and presence while sharing her Hardee's cappuccino and cookie with my dad when they parked and looked out at Lake Superior through the windshield than most people could get from a full-blown meal at a town's most expensive restaurant. And when she felt well and energetic enough to actually go into a restaurant herself, she'd study the menu with a delighted concentration on her face and enter into a little discussion with each of us about what we would be having. Thousands of times, I've observed people rush into department stores, head straight for their item, slap down their card, and stride out like they had a plane to catch. I've observed myself do it. My mother, though, limited to mostly shopping from home, would pore through her stacks of catalogs. She'd ask me, "What do you think of this sweater for Amy?" and hand me the picture of one of a dozen pages with the corners folded down. On the phone, she'd visit with the customer service person, first about patterns and colors and sizes, but soon it'd be where he or she lived, where my mother lived, the weather moving across the country between locales. She once visited with a woman from L.L. Bean for almost 2 hours. I wish I'd been there to hear it. Not that she was lonely, or that she pushed, even subtly, her conversation on people. True to her Scottish descent, my mother had that combination of impeccable manners and genuine friendliness I've seen in so many Scots in their own country. It was simply that she had an abiding interest in other people's lives, a capacity for empathy based on an imagination that could occupy others' concerns, pleasures, and hopes as naturally as most of us occupy our own. In particular, her empathy and good wishes went out to the less celebrated. For example, though she was of medium build herself, she felt a particular solidarity with heavy people. A lone student walking across campus, sweating and uncomfortable in his clothes, the tiny backpack straps pulling hard and wide at his shoulders, might bring her to say quietly, "I hope he has someone at home who can't wait to hear how his day went." Forgive me if I seem to eulogize. If I do so, it's not only to remember, but also to perpetuate such attentiveness and generosity of spirit in myself. On our way to Scotland, Amy and Anya and I spent a couple weeks in Marquette, and I learned that my mother's Hardee's had closed. A surprising sadness moved through me. The chance to go through the drive-thru and ask for Diane, the day manager, and if she was working, trade some stories about my mother, then order my coffee and take it down to the park and sit and watch the lake and the seagulls, was gone forever. But where do kindness and love of living such as my mother possessed go? Having lost a premature daughter, a grandfather, and my mother, I still don't have anything to say about religious notions of the afterlife. But when I speak to my mother, I often ask to feel that quiet awareness and that kindness of hers. I ask to be capable of bringing more quiet awareness and kindness into reality myself. Anya's bedtime story request typically involves something about Harry, Ron, and Hermione, of course. Lately, Harry is supposed to get hurt and wind up in the hospital wing, at which point Anya props up her leg on a spare pillow and says, "Ron, is that you? I'm in a lot of pain, Ron." Again and again, she wants to imagine and act out the courage to go on. After I've given her a final tuck-in, I tell her I'm making a Nana nest. I bunch the pillows up around her head, lift her quilt to her chin, and wrap it snugly around her body and legs and feet. "Just like Nana used to do for me," I tell her. Last night, Anya said, "I miss Nana." She says this from time to time. It's genuine, but it's also her own way of keeping my mother present, her 8-year-old's equivalent of my Nana nest. But last night, instead of just answering, "I miss her too," I said, "She used to call you my little sprite in the garden." Anya wailed, and sudden tears came as grief erupted from deep within her. "I miss Nana," she moaned. The muscles around her mouth and eyes clenched as she wept. This was her loss, too, and the void of it hit her all at once. Someone who'd loved her exquisitely, and who, at her core, she remembered loving, was gone. She'd been a few months short of her 4th birthday when my mother died, and it had been more than 4 years ago. But Anya's grief rose suddenly like a rogue wave over a small boat. Amy came rushing into the room, bringing her soft voice and commiseration. "I do too, baby," she said, as she crawled into the bed and put her arms around Anya. "She was wonderful, and she loved you so much." Earlier in the day, Anya and I had sat out on the old stone seawall, which curves its arm around the tiny harbor. Daisies growing from the mortar tilted in the breeze, but we were warm enough in the sun, which had finally returned to the coast of Fife. "Daddy," she asked me, "do you think Nana turned into a seagull?" At some point in the last year or two, I had told her offhandedly about some people's belief in reincarnation, about how it'd be nice to think of Nana as one of the birds she enjoyed so much, a Canada goose perhaps, or a seagull. But my offhandedness hadn't fooled her for a minute. When I'm alone running and pass a goose floating on a pond, or one flies low and honking over me, or a seagull walks across some pavement toward me, I speak to my mother. "Hi, Ma," I say, and update her on Anya and Amy, on how my writing's going, on how I'm doing as a husband and father on my day. I don't care if this is called belief or ritual or even sentimentality. It is what I will always do, what I told my mother I would do that final week we had left to say such things. "I'll talk to you," I said, leaning over her wheelchair, my voice close to her ear. I'll go on speaking to you in the passing birds. She nodded a morphine groggy nod and whispered, "Yes." So the dispassionate, fatherly explanation of reincarnation I'd given Anya at some point in the last year or two hadn't fooled her. She knows me. Out on the seawall, I'd answered her as completely as I could manage while seagulls wheeled high in the wind over our cottage across the harbor. "I hope so. I feel like she's here somewhere. A seagull seems right." I'd put my hand on her chest. "But no matter what, I know she's here. She's in you when you think of her. She's in our love for each other, every moment of it." Now, as Anya's sudden wave of grief broke over her, I lay down in her bed and wrapped my arm over her and Amy. "Nana's here in our family, Anya," I said. "I miss her too. So much I don't know what to do sometimes. But she's still here in our family." The three of us stayed like that, with the seagulls outside in the near dark of the long northern dusk beyond our cottage windows, until Anya was asleep. Fear spreads across my consciousness like a change of light across the surface of the sea, like light draining. The darkening air turns cold like the water. Here, back again, is the terrible, familiar fear that Amy or Anya or I have some horrific disease. Who wants to admit, even to oneself alone on paper, to such mental torment, to such wastefulness of life? Today, the would-be harbinger is a red spot way back in my mouth, on my cheek behind the last tooth, hard to see in the mirror with a flashlight as I pull the side of my mouth open and cock my head for another look. Perhaps the 10th look this afternoon. I can't tell you how depressed the return of this hypochondriacal anxiety has me. Since we've been in Scotland, there'd been no worry eating away at my focus on the sun or rain on the sea. No nagging thought, but this time it could be something, about a freckle or a swollen lymph node or a little ache between me and the words Amy and Anya said about what to have for a picnic lunch or if we should call our friends in the States to say hello. My mind had been free until this red spot in my mouth. My entire adult life, my mother's health was tenuous. A heart attack at 40 when I was in high school. A few years later, a rare liver disease that was supposed to prove fatal in no more than 15 years. A few years later, a strangely bleeding stomach that left her so anemic she'd needed twice monthly blood transfusion. Then, a few years later, came the first black patch on the tip of a middle toe. Leaving academia for gardening and long, leisurely walks every day soothed her heart. A new medicine from Mayo Clinic turned her liver tests completely around. Her fourth or fifth gastroenterologist finally diagnosed and cauterized the raw vessels in her stomach. Even the amputation of her toe worked, for a while, and succeeded in stopping the gangrene, and in a couple months she was back to her leisurely walks. For every threat, there were countermeasures. Oh, those sweet countermeasures. And there was vigilance. My mother was reasonably cautious, checking her blood sugar when she should, keeping appointments, calling her doctors if something suspicious came up. But she was also busy with the flowers in the first backyard she'd ever owned, and the friendship of a new dear daughter-in-law, and those Hardee's cappuccinos, and the bread crusts she had to remember to bring the seagulls. It was my father and I who asked if she felt okay when she'd sigh too heavily, who checked her temperature 6 or 7 or 10 or 12 times a day when she got the flu, and who inspected every blister or cut for signs that this was the beginning of another crisis. Once, a routine angiogram left her with an infection in her femoral artery. The infection resulted in a huge open wound where her thigh joined her abdomen, and later, when the femoral artery burst and spilled blood onto the hospital bed and floor and nurse's gloved hands and scrubs, emergency surgery, and days in the ICU, then weeks of lying in a hospital bed awaiting every day's torturous cleaning of her open wound, with salt water. And even then, she eventually came home. A couple months later, I was strolling with her and my father and sister on the shore of Lake Superior again. The sun filtered down through leaves, My father swung a stick through tall grass. We talked about catching a movie in the evening. Always our vigilance and medicine's countermeasures paid off. Now, though, much as I hate to admit it, I'm someone who has lived through years of periodic, potentially deadly crises. Afraid to relax my guard, trained by rough experience to maintain a vigilance that again and again meant life went on. I ate a lot of crackers last night. Ritz crackers with cheddar cheese. Maybe I was a little homesick. Ritz are sharp. The insides of one's cheeks are tender and given to little abrasions. That's what most people would think if they'd bothered to look at the little sore spot at all. Such a waste of a day, this consuming fear. And after I've seen my mother's example again and again of how to value and fully inhabit a day in the face of real reasons for fear, I feel apologetic to her for this waste, apologetic to Scotland out the window beyond my desk, to Amy and Anya somewhere down on the beach without me.
That brings us to the end of tonight's episode of The Desk on the Sea, written and read by Jonathan Johnson. Thank you for listening. Join us next time to continue Jonathan's story. Music for this episode is by Cerdwin and Greg Spatz. I'm Ben Reed.